I wish one could know them, I wish there were tokens to tell the fortunate fellows that now you can never discern. And then one could talk with them friendly and wish them farewell and watch them depart on the way that they will not return. But now you may stare as you like, and there's nothing to scan, and brushing your elbow unguessed and not to be told, they carry back bright to the coiner the mintage of man, the lads that will die in their glory and never be old.
That's an excerpt from A Shropshire Lad, a song issued along with Bibles as part of war rations given to all British soldiers in World War I. The song was composed by George Butterworth, who was killed by a sniper in a battle in 1916 and buried in an unmarked grave. Butterworth is one of several song composers whose music reflects the growing tensions leading up to World War I. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
How did composers such as Maurice Ravel, Charles Ives, and others from the early decades of the 20th century combine lyrics and melodies in new ways? Why was a Madison composer of a cycle of love songs fired from his university job? Joining us to discuss and sample musical responses to World War I is Paul Rowe, professor of voice, along with professor of piano Martha Fisher, both from the UW School of Music.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
And how did you stumble across this trove of Wisconsinoniana and World War I interwoven?
Well, it's sort of a long story, but I'll tell the reduced version if I can. I got interested in the Indian mounds around Madison and was studying that, sort of reading books about it. And in one of the books that I read, there was a picture of Charles Brown, who was the head of the Historical Society at the time and really involved in this preservation effort. And he was on a hill with the minister of the Unitarian Church and a poet named William Ellery Leonard, who it said was a University of Wisconsin poet. And I'd never heard of him. And so I started reading about him and looking him up. And it turns out he was a distinguished professor here from 1906 to 1944. And he actually wrote, when they unveiled the Lincoln statue that's up by Bascom Hill, he wrote the dedicatory poem and he recited it at that event. So he was a well-known figure and known nationally and internationally for his translations of Greek mythology and translations, and also as a poet. And he wrote an autobiography, too, called The Locomotive God, which is sort of an interesting read. But during his time here, he was educated partly in Göttingen, which was a normal thing for professors in America to finish their education in Germany. And when he was back in Madison, there was a composer who was hired to be the head of the School of Music in 1909, and his name was Louis Adolf Körner. We're not really sure how to pronounce his name, but he was here until 1914 when he was mysteriously fired in the middle of the year. Where the circumstances of that are just not clear. But he and Leonard were cooperating to write these songs. They actually wrote four different sets of songs. These were the ones that I liked the best, and that sort of started me on this whole thing. So these were published in 1915, but first performed in 1914, and they were finished in November of that year.
When were these songs a response to World War I at this
point?
Well,
it was sort of the growing anxiety about the Germans. And I think on campus, because Körner had also studied in Germany with a man named Rheinberger, who is a composer, and Körner's most famous event was an opera that he composed that was performed in Bremen in 1905, and it was the first opera by an American performed in a German opera house. So he was actually kind of on the way in his career, and I think they were all worried about events in Germany and how it was going to affect their position at school because their credentials were German, and a lot of them were German, oriented toward German language, and even though their philosophy was very Germanic.
So in this collaborative work between Kerna and the School of Music and William Ellery Leonard, what sort of songs came out of it? What did you perform when you put on this concert?
Well, these are love songs. And the love thing is, again, with Leonard, everything seems to be complicated. And he was married to a woman who was the daughter of a professor here. And she committed suicide after a couple of years of marriage. And he was not ostracized exactly, but he was criticized by society because they felt like he had somehow let her kill herself, or some, even though she'd had mental problems before. So a lot of the poetry is written with that in mind. That, and you can, if you know that as a background, you can hear this, because this is at a time when he was engaged to another woman who was a former student, who he actually ended up marrying twice in his life. But this is the first time they got married. And so these are sort of saying that she is his salvation from that previous negative, that she was able to look beyond all the problems and accept him as a person. And there are a couple of quotes in here where it's really, well, a lot of the poetry says stuff like, the first one says, "Come love to me, old griefs have made me dumb. My palms not yet can bring you flowers." And then it says, you know, we've had this happy time, and now all those problems are past. And that's sort of the, I think, why this is a cycle of love songs.
And before you perform these for us, anything we should particularly listen to for in the music?
Yes, actually, one of the odd things about this is that there's a whole chart of themes. And so what he did was write leitmotifs, like we think of in Wagner. And so there are, do you want to just play like
sure.
the motive of pleading?
The maybe? Motive of pleading.
That's that first one. So that's the motive of, and it's actually printed. There are 18 motives printed in the front of the music. So you can follow along in case you get lost somewhere. And he brings them back at various times. So it's an interesting thing that they're all kind of correlated. That's what they call them here.
I would also say that from a stylistic standpoint, it's interesting music because it really feels a little bit like a turn-of-the-century parlor song. Like, you know, she's only a bird in a gilded cage or something.
Yes, right.
I mean,
that
it has a little bit of that, I don't know, overly sweet,
kind of
sentimental
Charles
K. Harris
kind of sound.
Feeling.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And yet, harmonically, they're rather adventurous.
What that motif you just played? I was
exactly.
going to say you don't
but,
know where that's
you'll,
going.
But you'll see what we mean. It's interesting.
Yeah. One of the things we did on this program, which I don't think we're going to get to in this on this show today, is that opening thing, that ba-dum, ba-dum, and the harmony that accompanies it. When I first was playing through these, I thought, boy, that sounds so familiar. What is it? And finally I realized it's from a Wolf. There's a set of Wolf songs. And basically, and this is the time he was in Germany, when Wolf was alive, when Kerna was there. And so he would have been aware. Rheinberger knew Wolf, kind of, you know, that his name had circulated. And I think he stole it, basically.
Well, let's call it a subconscious borrowing.
Borrowing, maybe. Okay.
Adapting.
But, yeah. But it doesn't pay off. I mean, it's not like Wolf, where Wolf continues things in that vein. But it's like he takes those ideas and then adapts them to sort of the American taste, something like that. So it's an interesting combination of styles.
And I see that the first song in this cycle is called I Need You So.
Indeed.
Have made me dumb. My palms not yet can bring you flowers. I know. I can but plead, beloved. Come, oh come. I need you. Come, my feet long lame from wanderings in the snow. Some joy and some great kindness shall be ours. I need you so. Come, love, to me. All griefs have made me dumb. My palms not yet can bring you flowers, I know. I can but plead, beloved, come, oh come. I need you so.
This is the first song of a cycle. There are
five
songs in the cycle, and when you say cycle, which is a very old song tradition. Schubert, for example, wrote some really long song cycles, as you know, Paul, as you have performed and recorded some of them. There's an implication of a plot line.
Right. Or a theme.
Some kind of progression here.
Right. With Schumann, you know, it would be a theme, the poet's love or woman's life and love or something like that. And this is more along those lines, I think, than the Schubert cycles.
So what kind of progression do we see as we go from the first song to the second song in the set?
There's not a lot of actually emotional progression. There's been struggles. Now you've helped me get through this. And basically, I think that's the theme of all of them.
Yeah. And I would just say what holds it together is that we actually hear the same themes in each piece. So that's what makes this a cycle. You know, lots of times in a traditional song cycle, the music will be at the beginning and then it will come back at the end,
right,
which pulls it together. In this, you have the same kind of music throughout all five of the pieces. And back when Paul was talking about these different motives, you know, the motive of resolve, the motive of pleading, the motive of the maidenhood. You know, that's the motive of maidenhood. And we'll hear that.
Tremolo there.
Well, we get tremolos.
There are tremolos,
but not in that.
And it's from 1914. How is this also a World War I piece besides the date? Is it something about that sense of yearning or?
No, I think the World War I thing is that both these two men were involved in a protest kind of thing. There was a faculty member who was fired named Feise. And because of his German connections, and that may be where they got together. I don't know how they met. There's not much information about that available.
So just the idea of taking the German leader and bringing it here and working with it somehow
right.
is almost like a political...
Well, I think it is. I think they were pro-German. They were known as pro-German. And since the U.S. hadn't entered the war at that point, that there were still people kind of dividing up, deciding which way. We didn't know if we were going to go... which side we would be on.
Well, that perhaps had a little something to do with the hasty departure of Mr. Kerner?
I'm not sure. They're really, in everything I've looked at, it's a mystery. There are books about the University of Wisconsin and even about the School of Music where it just says he was dismissed. and he fought it. He was the leader of what was called the Madison Singing Club, I think. And he was at the Congregational Church as well, and they protested his firing. There was a whole thing with the regents and everything. Chancellor Van Hise did not take an active role in this, but I think there was one of the deans did. I mean, it was some fight. So who knows? Well, I'm hoping to find out more about it, actually.
Well, the next song in the cycle I see is called You Will Understand.
Yeah.
I like the idea of just saying you will understand, kind of making it a declarative statement.
Right.
You have had sorrow, dearest, you know less. Tears, secret tears, when none were nigh to guess. Tears when when the strangers led you by the hand. Oh, you will understand. You have had sorrow, dearest, you know less. You drank love's cup from springs of bitterness, and purchased hope erewhile in dead men's land. Oh, you will understand.
Those dead men's hands. That's a World War I image.
It is.
We'll come to that a little bit later. To you, from failing hands, we throw the torch.
Right.
I think there's also the treasuring of our homeland, you know, that the American feel that's in these songs. Even though they have, as you said, these sort of harmonic complexities that sound kind of Germanic. And you have to wonder, the guy's name is Louis Adolf Kerne,
right.
What his own sort of DNA was. But
well, he was the first PhD in music from Harvard.
Is that so? Now, that's interesting. You know, because, you know, I wish I could remember the dates exactly, but I want to say about 1908 it was that Van Hise got rid of Eugene Looning.
Right.
Looning was a kind of a free spirit, but he said he was very conscious about Harvard and about credentials. And I know that Looning was replaced with a PhD from Harvard.
Right.
So that must be
this guy.
This
would be
guy.
Right at the right time.
Right.
And his dissertation for his PhD, his document, was an orchestration treatise on how to orchestrate. And that was a standard treatise up until about 1950. People used that.
Those credentials.
Yep.
Is there another one of the three remaining pieces in the cycle that you can sing?
Sure. And this one is called Crones of the Valley. It's the fourth one in the cycle. And in some ways, the most pointed talking about this sort of social outcast status that Leonard had and how this woman is going to rescue him from that, from being outside of society.
That's from the Psycho of Love lyrics by Louis Adolf Koerner. We're going to be back in a moment with some World War I music from Charles Ives. This is University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guests are Paul Rowe and Martha Fisher, and we're exploring the music of World War I. Just a few years after the birth of Louis Koerner in 1870, we have Charles Ives, born in this country in 1874, coming along and writing music in the 1918-1919 time period. Can you tell us about Charles Ives and how he fits into this period you're talking about?
Well, Ives is one of the great American composers and one of the first Americans to really have their own voice. And he studied with Horatio Parker at Yale and famously fought with Parker and wanted to experiment, and Parker wanted him to do the sort of traditional theory things and all that, and Ives resisted it. He was an organist and played all kinds of things, and Ives sort of rejected the whole idea and went into the insurance business. So he made a lot of money in the insurance business and was a commuter.
He still has patents that are Ives patents. I mean, he's as famous in the insurance world as, well, or maybe right. even more
yeah,
so
he
as he is as a musician.
Created the concept of estate planning.
Yeah.
That was Charles Ives.
Right. He's a brilliant guy. But what that did was enable him to write whatever he wanted in whatever style. He wasn't depending on music to be his livelihood. And so what he did these were published in 1950, something like that. He put together a book of 114 songs. And this is part of that. That's the source material for a lot of the Ives songs. And one of the reasons that, we know this is World War I because of the music. He quotes different popular songs at the time and songs that refer directly to World War I. So these dates may be close to right. One of the things about Ives is that he was quirky enough that he would misdate things. And there are lots of experimental things, sort of 12-tone things, cluster, you know, real experimental things that he dates before Schoenberg and stuff. And no one really knows if that's true or not.
Who got there first.
Right. And one of the things I think that's, well, there are a lot of remarkable things about Ives, but in these songs in particular, so he mixes the sort of popular song, you'll recognize some of the tunes, a very experimental sort of musical style. So he'll sometimes be very plain, just set the tune, and other times it'll be kind of crazy. And it creates sort of a collage effect, which is similar to what was going on in literature and in painting at the time. So he's really right involved with all of that. And musically, he's trying to portray what maybe Dada was after or Proust or those kind of ideas.
But he was coming away from a very real experience. His father, I think, had been a bandmaster.
Right.
And so he must have grown up hearing a lot of, bands playing simultaneously different things, and he loves to do that effect, effect of the passing parade.
Oh, yeah.
These things overlap and then fade and separate.
Right. And supposedly the family was, they were encouraged, he and the rest of his siblings were encouraged to argue and were taught to play in one key and sing in another, hymns.
Yeah.
so that there was this sort of Yankee independence that they were fostering, both in philosophy. I think it was similar in the James household too, with William and Henry. But it's that idea that you should have your own voice and argue for what you think is right,
even if it's dissonant.
especially if it's dissonant. I think
this is maybe the most famous World War I poem that Ives has said by Dr. John McCrae, who was one of those unfortunates who died during World War I. The story behind the poem is McCrae wrote it and threw it away. He wrote it, on the edge of a battlefield, threw it away, and somebody found it, picked it up, and it took off.
Hmm. What you hear in this song, Paul was talking about popular songs, but what you also hear are patriotic songs. that are specifically about America. But they're kind of twisted in the way that you hear them, both rhythmically and harmonically. And then, you know, in some of them you get those just pure, simple statements of hymn tunes. In the third song that we do, you hear that as well.
So we'll hear Charles Ives in Flanders Fields, Tom Sails Away, and Down East.
Today,
my childhood are floating before my eyes.
I'm kind of reminded of Salvador Dali. Do you know where I'm coming from? There's something that's perfectly familiar, and then it's wilted.
Right, there's a little twist somewhere.
There's something not quite right with it from a traditional standpoint. It's the kind of thing that about the same time or a little later, Ravel was doing with La Valse, and he would take that Viennese waltz tradition and just make it a little off-kilter.
Yep.
And it gives you a sense of disjointedness a bit. Just when you start to settle in and savor a melody, suddenly something happens and it's like, oh, no, we're not in a hymn.
There's, there's something for everyone, but not necessarily the way they want it. It's kind of cheek to jowl with something they don't necessarily find familiar or comforting.
I think that's true of Ives. A lot of Ives is just that. There's some little turn that throws you off just a little bit.
And I guess it would just be a few years after that Yeats would write, "Things fall apart, the center cannot hold."
That's right.
So in terms of how this fits with World War I, how did Charles Ives feel about the war?
Well, I assume he was a pacifist. I don't really know. Everything that he wrote about it in music, anyway, is a protest in one way or another. It's the lost youth. I don't know anything that he's written, like letters or anything like that, where he talks directly about it. But everything is a protest of the war itself, which would go along with a lot of his attitudes, I think.
And that theme of youth, whether lost or remembered, is very big in Ives.
Yes. And the lost, the sort of fading of the 19th century and the loss of innocence and that whole idea.
Yeah, he was right in the front row for that.
Mm-hmm.
That also comes up in the George Butterworth song that we open the hour with, A Shropshire Lad.
Sure. A Shropshire Lad was actually written, was Houseman's reaction to the Boer War, and it was first published in 1895. And A. E. Houseman was had sort of a reputation. He was tied in with the Oxford crowd, and so he was well-educated and was able to publish this himself in a small run in 1895. And then over the years, it gained in popularity. And the overall themes, I think, of A Shropshire Lad are the fading of the British Empire, lost youth, again, like we were talking about. And then it became particularly poignant when World War I broke out. And the Tommies, as the British soldiers were called, were supplied a copy of this and the Bible to carry with them into what ended up into trench warfare. But it really symbolized that sort of British, what they're proud of the most in England, the empire and the finery of that. The undercurrent of all of Houseman's writing is his homosexuality. And he, at the time, in 1895, was also the Oscar Wilde trial in England.
Yes.
And so there are little things in A Shropshire Lad where he describes the men in their uniforms and the, you know, there's a whole sort of undercurrent of that. That, you know, I think it was certainly there. You know, and Butterworth actually dealt with the same issues, and they think it may be one of the reasons that he volunteered and was so, well, when he was killed, he was leading a charge out of the trenches, and that they think that he was trying to defend his masculinity in some way. There are some theories of that.
We could argue the whole war was about that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But he was a good example of that he was well-connected in the musical community in England and was a great friend of Vaughan Williams and of Cecil Smart. But he didn't really write much else besides these are sort of the Shropshire Lad.
I mean, he was pretty young when
he was very young. And he went around collecting folk tunes, so there's a folk element in the music. But he actually used these as source material for string music as well. So the Shropshire Lad was a very important thing to Butterworth in his whole compositional career.
And we're going to listen to the music of George Butterworth when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests, baritone Paul Rowe, and at the piano, Martha Fisher, and we're looking at music, songs from and about World War I, including, in this case, the English composer George Butterworth, who was one of the casualties of the war, and wrote, as many people did, music to the poetry of A.E. Houseman. What is it that's distinctive about Butterworth's music, though?
I think the main thing is that you can hear that he's in line with the British interest in folk song, and there's a certain modal harmonic element and a simplicity. There's a real clear, he follows the text organization pretty clearly, and I think that's the main thing, is the simplicity of it.
Yeah, and you have all those sort of typical British harmonies with suspensions, like you get a lot of that kind of thing in Butterworth. It sounds very British to me. extremely English in the harmonies aren't that adventurous, but there's just something about us as Americans, too, that I think it's kind of in our DNA, in our cultural DNA. And I completely agree with Paul, the simplicity and also the way that the text is set is very, in some cases, very spoken-like, very almost recitative in some sections.
It's mostly syllabic.
Yeah.
You know, there aren't a lot of melismas. Mm-hmm. And beautiful tunes.
Just beautiful tunes. Yeah. Writes good tunes. That's another British
and
thing.
And this poem has been said, I gather, by more people than almost any other.
It seems to me, I know there are, I've probably sung at least six or seven, and I know there's at least 50, if not 60 settings of this one poem, Loveliest of Trees.
Well, let's hear what George Butterworth did with it.
Of trees, the cherry now is hung with bloom along the bough, and stands about the woodland round, wearing score years and 10, 20 will not come again, and take from 70 springs a score, it only leaves me 50 more. And since to things in bloom, 50 springs are little room about the woodlands. I will go to see the cherry hung with
snow. So beautiful. And it's also, I guess, poignant to listen knowing that the composer was killed in the war.
Right. That adds a lot to it, I think, actually, knowing that background. I find that with a lot of music.
With the second piece, When I Was Young and 20, again, that looking back at youth.
Right.
The wasting of youth.
And it is almost all the poems are looking back, are through a memory. You know, there are, even though some of them sound like they're from the time, from the when the guy's 20, but most of them really are memories or looking back.
And as we hear When I Was Young and 20, what should we listen for?
I think this is actually one of the few joke songs. There are two different voices speaking. There's the young man and the old man giving advice. And I think that there's poignancy there too, as with all these poems, but it's also, I think especially now we come to the end of the year and you look back at all the college students here in Madison. And this is a classic thing for a college student.
When I was 21, I heard a wise man say, give crowns and pounds and guineas and not your heart away. Give pearls away and rubies, but keep your fancy free. But but I was 21, no use to talk to me. When I was 21, I heard him say again, the heart out of the bosom was never given in vain. 'Tis paid with sighs aplenty and sold for endless rue. And I am 22, and all 'tis true, 'tis true.
What is the overall thrust of A Shropshire Lad? I mean, of that collection, it seems so multifaceted already.
Right. Yeah. I think it's really looking back at the end of empire and the sort of lost innocence of the British Empire. And I think they were, with the Boer War, it was similar, I think, in some ways to the way the United States has stepped into the Middle East and gotten in over its head and not really sure where we're going to go and all that stuff. And I think the British Empire was in a similar situation. They wanted to police the world, and the Boer War was very distant, and yet they were sending young men over there, and they weren't coming back. And so I think that's a lot of it. That's what prompts it. But then there's the personal side, too, that Houseman really balances, I think, very nicely.
And by the time we get to World War I mean, Shropshire Lad for Butterworth is 1911 for when he composed the music.
Right.
By the time we get to World War I in Britain, that really seems to have been sort of the crucible of the whole British, you know, psyche in a way. I remember thinking years ago, Masterpiece Theater, if you think back, wow, how many of those were set, you know, right between like 1910 and 1920? The British just couldn't get over it.
That's right.
What happened then? That's kind of collective trauma.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think the, you know, America was coming up as an industrial power and an international power. And I think it was just a very complicated time and could have gone a lot of different ways. You know, that's one of the things that this got me to reading about was that, you know, if World War I had not turned out the way it did, things could be very different now. I mean, that's a real turning point in history, just like World War II was.
But and I've always kind of been intrigued by this, too, the difference between those two wars in terms of the poetic output. There was something about, I mean, there was poetry written, you know, during and about World War II, but there's something about World War I, and maybe it did have to do with this kind of culmination of a certain kind of naivete that really elicited all these poems, particularly, I mean, from soldiers. There was some very good poetry written by World War I soldiers, right, such as Butterworth.
I also think there was a difference in the people who went to war. By World War II, the armies were so much larger. It seems to me, anyway, in the Boer War and the war in Crimea and also in the World War I, they were royalty lead. They were the upper class was leading things, and the educated class was going to war almost as an adventure or,
yes,
you know, there was another sort of feel to it. By World War II, it was more industrial. You know, mm-hmm. You don't read about college people dropping out and going over there to get the experience.
It's more like a job in a way. I mean, it was a job that needed to be done, but it was almost more business-like without the sense of sort of this emotional, you know, involvement in the cause.
And wounding of the British psyche. It's true. I mean, I've been reading those books lately, the Maisie Dobbs series. I'm trying to remember who the author is, but it all takes, you know, it's this woman detective. It's all between the wars. And then, of course, I don't know if you watched Foyle's War on PBS, but it's a great, and again, a detective who's dealing with the trauma of the war at home and after the war, the trauma after the war. And it's pretty interesting.
It does.
And there's a lot of imagery of the sort of the green fields, sort of nostalgia for a time that was less urban as well. Is there another piece of A Shropshire Lad that we might hear?
Well, I think Martha and I both feel like the last one of this set of songs is My Team Plowing is the name of it. And in it, it's two characters again, two figures speaking. One is the boy who stayed behind, and the other one is the one who left and went to war and didn't come back. And so we don't know if it's the one who's left's conscience, because there are some events that are talked about, and it's reality of, I think, the way life was. If you lost someone and they didn't come back from war, what happens at home? So that this deals with that.
Is my team plowing that I was used to drive, and hear the harness jingle when I was man alive? I the horses trample, the harness jingles now. No change though you lie under the land you used to plow. Is football playing along the river shore with lads to chase the leather? Now I stand up no more. I the ball is flying, the lads play heart and soul. The goal stands up, the keeper stands up to keep the goal. Is my girl happy that I thought hard to leave? And has she tired of weeping as she lies down at eve? Aye, she lies down lightly, she lies not down to weep. Your girl is well contented. Be still, my lad, and sleep. Is my friend hearty now I am thin and pine? And has he found to sleep in a better bed than mine? Yes, lad, I lie easy, I lie as lads would choose. I cheer a dead man's sweetheart. Never ask me who.
Another one of those dialogues between the living and the dead.
That's
like
right.
In Flanders Fields, which of course proves very poignant when you're talking about that World War I era.
Our guests sharing the music of the World War era have been Paul Rowe, baritone, and Martha Fisher, pianist. What a pleasure. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
It's been fun.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.